You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Today, we head to West Virginia, but perhaps not for the cryptid, you may presume. Dr. Russell Jones joins me to discuss his newly updated second edition of Tracking the Stone Man, West Virginia's Bigfoot. We crisscross between Ohio and the Mountain State to look at theories, potential behaviours, and some sightings. As a certified master naturalist, experienced outdoorsman, and passionate Bigfoot researcher, Dr. Jones expands our knowledge for the search for the elusive. But before all that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to each and every one of my patrons for their continued support. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media networks, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Time to talk tactics, common sense, and cryptids as we attempt to track the Stone Man. As US states go, West Virginia's most famous cryptid may hog all the headlines, but for those in the know, it's a hotbed of Bigfoot activity. Guiding us around these hotspots that the Mountain State has to offer is someone I've wanted to speak to for a long time, Dr. Russ Jones. In his updated second edition, the award-winning book continues to prove itself invaluable to anyone with an interest in Bigfoot, cryptozoology, or is simply curious about their history. Dr. Jones, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Thank you, my friend. Appreciate you having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Now, I'm probably showing how much I've been interested in this. You first came to my attention when I believe you appeared in an episode of Finding Bigfoot.
Okay.
Which was obviously shown over here in the UK and Europe. I think it's probably about 10 times, because I know they did a few episodes trying to track down things in West Virginia, Russ. And but this is something that you've had a lifelong interest in since you were a child, since you were about 12 years old, I believe.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, I had I grew up in a family in Southeast Ohio where I still do research and I have a farm there. And New Year's Day, we got about 4 inches of snow on New Year's Eve, and it was New Year's Day was a beautiful, sunny, bright day, but very cold in the 20s. And I was out with a friend running my rabbit dogs and came along a hillside. We had about 4 inches of snow on the ground from the night before. And there was a cave up above me on the hillside that I was familiar with. But when I came along, I saw barefooted human footprints in the snow. It was apparent that they were very fresh. It was apparent that something had heard me coming and had left that cave. I guess they were probably, it was probably weathering the storm in that cave until it heard me coming along with my dogs, and then it left. And of course, I knew nothing of Bigfoot. And I thought, being in the 70s, it was, I don't know, maybe some type of drug addict or some hippie or something was walking in the snow. And so I went up and looked in the cave expecting there to be clothes in there or maybe a fire. There was none of that. And so my friend and I talked about it for a long time and what it might be. And then later that summer, I was maybe 3 or 4 miles away from there at a very remote beaver dam that no one knew about but my family. And I heard something coming up to the water as I was fishing across the water from me about 40 yards away. And something started shaking the bushes and screaming very monkey-like. And the behavior went on for about a minute. I still didn't know what it was. I wasn't afraid. I was in the woods all the time and wasn't fearful of things. And of course, I was wearing a pistol because there was a lot of snakes in that area. But later that year, I was watching the show In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy. I don't remember if it was a rerun or what it was, but I saw he had In Search of Bigfoot. and it lit a fire under me, and I got curious. And a couple more times in the next couple of years, I had found footprints. And then I went on. Of course, I was an undergraduate, which is 4 years here, and then doctor school is another five. And then when I came to practice, I came to West Virginia, which is just south of Ohio. And it appealed to me because of the wild, rugged wilderness. And I was still already consumed with Bigfoot and reading everything that had went on in the Bigfoot world. I didn't know anybody in the Bigfoot world. I had never been to any conferences or anything like that. But eventually I became a certified master naturalist. And I saw that Dr. Jeff Meldrum, which is the anthropologist from Idaho State University, which wrote a book right then, called Legend Versus Science. And he was speaking a couple hours from me. And so I went up there, and there's around 300 people there. I knew nobody, of course, and listened to him speak. Then when I got home, if you Googled back then, Bigfoot on the internet, BFRO came up, the Bigfoot Field Research Organization, which was the only group at that time doing scientific research on Bigfoot. Mm-hmm. And about 10 or 12 times a year, they would have an expedition somewhere where, you know, you paid a few $100s, they interviewed you, you signed these non-disclosure forms. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to go. If they're weird, I'll leave. And ironically, during that expedition, I met two of my best friends. That was about 15 years ago. And they're still two of my best friends. And it just so happened on that expedition, Matt Moneymaker from the TV show Finding Bigfoot was there. And Matt and I just hit it off. Mm. And from that point on, I was doing the reports for the group in Ohio and West Virginia. Yeah. And that's how I got started in it.
Yeah. I do like the bit in the book where you're talking about going to the conference. And there's a particular witness, I think, who's explaining his encounter. And one of the audience members asked him what shirt he had on, what color it was. Yeah. And he told her, and she just sort of nodded. And you were like, what does this mean? And I would imagine, as someone that's yet to experience a proper Bigfoot conference, Russ, even though you've got a deep interest in this, you're going into uncharted territory. As you say, you've no idea what you're letting yourself in for. And when you see something like that and somebody just nods sagely as though, well, that makes sense to me. Yeah. I suppose you're just scratching your head and thinking, what on earth am I letting myself in for here?
I had no idea. You know, it was interesting on the way back. One of my friends called and said, what did you think? And I said, well, there was some pretty interesting people. And by interesting, I meant there was a wide and varied group of people there that were interesting, you know, not necessarily in a flattery manner. And she laughed and she said, Russ, you know, I don't want to be mean, but I'm reminding you that you went to a Bigfoot event. And still 15 years later, Bigfoot events are like that, you know, there's a wide variety. You'll have scientific minded people. You'll have people that look like they'd fit in on any university campus. And then you have, you know, more of a hippie type people there. So it's interesting, the dynamics inside Bigfoot and how the people relate. I think it's one of the most interesting things in the field. I think that if some of the social scientists were, it would be really interesting for them to step in and not figure out why people try to believe in Bigfoot, because many people have had sightings, but how the groups inside a Bigfoot world interact with each other.
Mm. Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's, without wishing to sound like it's a cliche, it's very much like an onion. There are so many layers to it that I think for a lot of people who look at it from the outside, they presume everybody's coming with the same belief system or the same sort of understanding of this. And even for someone such as myself, Russ, that's had a long interest in this particular subject, I would suggest that until I really started doing this show and speaking with people from around the world, I thought I knew a lot. What I now realize 4 years on is I knew very little.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of us feel like that as we go on, that there's aspects of it that we don't understand. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there's a greater understanding now than, say, there was, say, when the famous Patterson-Gimlin film was shot in October of 1967, that now there's a lot more scientific understanding. There's a lot more ability to accept the variance in the reports. There's more of a standard, I think. There's more of an understanding with the footprints, the vocalizations, that I think that, you know, some people would say that the evidence hasn't changed a great deal. And that, while that may be true, I think in general that the evidence is more widely understood than what it once was.
Mm, yeah. And I think it's one of the dangers of modern technology, that we've got so many resources at our fingertips that it's very easy to fall down the wrong path or, get into the wrong side of a particular investigation. And I know you've mentioned this one particular case in your book. These days, there are so many hoaxes floating around online. I'm mystified these days, Russ, how many times Bigfoot seems to appear on TikTok more than anything.
Yes. Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting that, you know, like in the group, you know, I'm part of the Untold Radio Network when I do my podcast, which is called Wide Open Research.
Mm-hmm.
And we have found that, you know, there's different, the seven of us do different subjects and whatnot, but usually many of us will touch on Bigfoot stuff. But whenever we vary away from the Bigfoot stuff, our views will drop. You know, for whatever reason, Bigfoot is the monster that many grew up in the United States with. And so there is a very large interest in it. I mean, you know, you think about finding Bigfoot at one point having 2 million viewers in its prime and lasting 10 seasons, which would be unheard of for almost any television show, let alone a Bigfoot show.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
It is. It is. And it just shows that the appetite is there for this particular subject regardless. And as someone that was a big fan of finding Bigfoot and watched every episode that was available to us over here, we got it slightly different over here. We basically got all the seasons amalgamated into four seasons of 24 episodes each.
Okay.
So it was a real pleasure for me to be there every Tuesday night waiting for it to come on. And as you mentioned in the book, and as we spoke about before we started the interview proper, I've discovered a real love of certain states. West Virginia is among them. Montana is another one that I've really become to appreciate just how beautiful it is. And I think one of the great aspects of this, regardless of this, the hunt for this elusive creature or cryptid or whatever people may believe it to be, is the fact that it still gets people out into some of the most beautiful parts of North America, regardless.
That's right. And that was one of my arguments that I made at the end of the first book, you know. So what if I get to the end and in the end I find out that Bigfoot didn't exist? Well, you know, how would I quantify spending hundreds and hundreds and thousands of hours in some of the most beautiful places when it's good for my health and it's good for my mental health? I mean, would it matter that much? I mean, I'm sure I would be disappointed, but you know, I don't think that I would probably go out any less than I do now, which is at least a couple times a week for sure.
Mm. There's a few interesting aspects to some of the information in regards to the amount of sightings, because I think often people have this presumption, especially in certain states, Russ, that everybody's out hiking all the time or going on long walks or mountain biking or hiking or climbing or whatever. And I think it's interesting that, as you say, you were somebody whose family were outside all the time. You were consistently hunting, you were searching, you were foraging, you were utilizing the land around you. And often a lot of people consider themselves to be outdoorsy people, but they might go out once a week, once a fortnight, once a month even, Russ. They're not really going out, are they?
No, you know, I remember I did a radio program for some radio station out of New Orleans, and the host, and they didn't really know anything about Bigfoot, but which is common with some of the shows that I do. And they would say something along the lines of, well, it seems like that if something was out there, that somebody would have kind of ran across it, or there'd be some more evidence or whatever. And I had to ask them, who's out there? I mean, I'm out there, but I don't see anybody. I mean, the places I go, it's very, very rare for me to even see someone. And, you know, and most of the places I go are within 20 minutes or 30 minutes of civilization, large cities. So, and I don't see anybody. I think that, you know, there was a study out of the University of Pennsylvania, not the University of Pennsylvania, but the state of Pennsylvania, where they, you know, put tracking collars or trackers on hunters. And what they found out was that well over 90% of the hunters never venture farther than a quarter mile from the nearest road or trail. And, you know, there was just an article in the Charlotte Observer newspaper not long ago that said, we've never been outside less in our lives. We're afraid of the dark. We're afraid of snakes. We're afraid of getting lost. We're afraid of everything. We're not familiar with the woods like our forefathers were.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting, you know, nationally about 22% of the people believe in Bigfoot, but it includes people from New York, Chicago, LA, large cities. Whereas in Appalachia or the Pacific Northwest, it's well over 50% of the people to believe. And for instance, earlier today, I was at a car dealership. I talked to only two people in there just in passing. both of the people had Bigfoot encounters. It's very, very common in places like West Virginia, where probably 80 or 90% of the male population is hunters. They're hunting in a remote place like West Virginia, and almost everyone has a story. And if they don't have a story, they know someone that has a story.
Well, I think that's a great point, because even when people do go out, they will usually stick to a trail, or they will go to a specific campground, Russ. They will not go into the woods. They're in the woods, but they're not going really into the woods, if that makes sense. So I find it frustrating sometimes. It's one of those modern myths, I think, where people say, oh, as you've referred to there, oh, well, why aren't people bumping into it more, or why have we not got more evidence? And people go, oh, well, we've discovered everything. We've been everywhere. I mean, even when we're talking about West Virginia, which is one of the smaller states, both in size and population in the US, it's smack in the Appalachian Mountains. It's known as the Mountain State. It is rugged. It is varied. Some people even consider it to be the eastern version of the Pacific Northwest because of its abilities and its elements there that completely stand it apart from anything else in the surrounding states.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that people would consider is it's been said that if you flattened West Virginia of all of its steep mountains and steep peaks, that it's actually the size of the entire United States. That's how steep and that's how mountainous the state is. There's many, many places where you can go dozens of miles in between roads, and it may take you well over an hour to an hour and a half just to get up the very first mountain, and there may be dozens and dozens of them before you would get into the next hollow or whatever. You know, and many of the areas are filled with copperheads and rattlesnakes, and people just don't go into those areas. It by itself is a remarkable place, but, you know, I think even places like Ohio, you know, which has the fourth most common number of sightings, Southeast Ohio, where I grew up, you know, it's nothing like West Virginia, but I spend a lot of time there because it's almost like fishing in a pond, whereas in West Virginia, many times, you know, if you're after Bigfoot type evidence, fishing here would be like fishing in an ocean. You know, it's very sparsely populated. There's just not very many people here. You know, and that's the thing about a Bigfoot sighting, right? You know, we estimate only one in every 20 sightings get reported. Many people have had Bigfoot encounters, but they don't recognize the Bigfoot behavior to know that what they encountered. So it's very common here for people just not to hear anything. People that live in the mountain communities are very closed-minded, not closed-minded, but closed-lipped. You know, they don't tell outsiders what they think or what they hear, but in almost every community you go in, you can find a place that the locals believe are haunted, or they've encountered something back in the woods that, you know, they don't think is natural.
I know, as I was saying about your upbringing and your family being very connected with nature and the world around you, I think sometimes people are surprised to hear people like yourself, Russ, would then go on to become interested in refining your skills. I think sometimes people have this presumption that if you live outdoors or you live in the woods or the countryside, that you're sort of genetically engineered to be akin with nature and attuned with everything. Whereas I've spoken to a lot of Bigfoot researchers who have clearly wanted to enhance their skills and learn more about the world around them. And with you becoming a master naturalist, like you say, and some states do master gardeners courses, I believe they're called as well, that it simply shows you a far bigger palette of nature that's in front of you, that even with your experience and your lifestyle prior to this, you were pretty well aware of, but I would imagine it's shown you a whole new world of it.
Yeah, so a master naturalist and a master gardener are two different things, and I'm both, but a master gardener it's a shorter car, you know, it's maybe 50 hours. It's related mainly to flowers, vegetables, soils, that type of thing. Maybe some trees that would be fruit trees or something like that. Whereas a master naturalist, there's many states that have different programs. West Virginia is one of the best. And when I took it, it meant that every other Friday for a year, on Friday night, I would have a 3-hour lecture from a university professor on a topic. It may be snakes, ferns, wildflowers, whatever it would happen to be. And then the next day, we were 3 hours in the woods studying what we had heard by lecture the night before. And there were around 40 classes. And you had to complete all of them in order to become a master naturalist. So I think that what I try to do is, you know, I grew up hunting, trapping. I grew up all the time in the woods. I grew up with the animals. and I know how animals behave. And then I try to combine that with the years of education I have and my science background and degrees to be in the woods and say, you know, like, for instance, people may see a tree that's broke or a stick that's broke, and they'll say, well, maybe it's the Bigfoot sign. And I would say, well, do you know what kind of tree it is? And of course, 99% of the time they don't, because for them, you know, they're not really interested in it. But for me, I would want to know what type of tree it is, what type of disease would strike that tree, at what height it would strike that tree. I would look, take a microscope or a field scope. I would look at the break, see if I could find some, people may say a tree's healthy, but you just can't tell unless you're looking at it through something like that. And so I think that one of the problems we have in Bigfoot world is that largely almost all of the research, I say with hyphens, is done by citizen scientists that don't have a background in, you know, any type of science, so to speak. They don't know how to collect evidence. They don't know how to go about it. So for them, the standard of evidence is much lower. And, you know, probably 3/4 of the people, you know, they're going out and camping in a spot they think is good for a Bigfoot activity. They're cooking bacon over the fire. They're hoping something comes into them. They're listening. They may take walks at night or something. But, I mean, it's really not something that you're going to get much evidence from. So there's probably only in the country maybe 100, maybe 150 people that are legitimately trying to collect evidence. And all those people, no one's getting paid to do it. I mean, you know, we may make money for speaking, we may make money on our books or a TV show or whatever it happens to be, but we're not getting money to do Bigfoot stuff. So if Bigfoot became acknowledged and say in West Virginia, a hunter shot one, because, you know, I've interviewed 3 different people that had clear open shots with their rifles that did not shoot. But let's say this year that one did, or that one got hit by a coal truck coming around a mountain, then the government would instantly come in. They would put a scientist in a place that no one's allowed to go. Maybe it's a watershed that is protected and patrolled. And so they would let somebody go in there with, you know, for months and months, and they would pay for their time, and they would have the greatest tools and everything else. And I think that when it happens, that everybody's going to be shocked at the amount of evidence that comes out, the people that are holding pictures and videos and maybe bones, that they just don't want to be called names. They just don't want people to think they're weird. They don't want to get in trouble. They don't want the notoriety. But I think that when it comes out, we're going to see a lot of that things, a lot of that type of thing happen.
Yeah. It seems to me that they're quite happy to let the citizen scientists drive this conversation, Russ, until, as you say, something compelling happens, and then they'll just swoop in and take the credit for everything, which will be a crying shame when you, and obviously with your experience in regards to the work that you've done for the BFRO, and obviously your speaking engagements, and through the book, no doubt, you've become entrenched in knowing who the best researchers are across the US, and there are people from Florida to the Pacific Northwest, across to New York, down into the Louisiana, around the Bayou areas. There are people all over the place who are spending weekends, hours out there studying, tracking, interviewing witnesses, collating a real body of evidence. And yet, with notable exceptions, Russ, nobody from officialdom is really sort of sticking their head above the parapet, as you say, primarily through fear of ridicule and loss of funding, I would suggest.
Yeah, I think that the reality, though, is of all those people that you're talking that are out there, that the great majority, maybe 90% of them, maybe even more than that, they're after an experience. They're not after evidence. They may say they're after evidence, but, you know, when you go to the woods, you know, you need to consider what type of evidence you may be, you know, able to collect, and do you have the ability to do it? You know, like recently, there was some clump of hair that somebody collected or whatever. Well, you know, they just grabbed it and they threw it in a plastic bag. And of course, that's not how we would collect something at all. Or, you know, they think that they have a track. You know, do they know how to cast a track? Do they know how to, you know, make that happen? Do they have somebody to evaluate it? I mean, they're really out there to have the experience. And I think that it's important that we do that. Like when all of us first got started, and probably most of the people in the nation that are interested at one time or another went on a BFRO expedition. And that's what it's out there for. It's out there that you are collecting, you know, evidence in theory, right? But, you know, you're really not getting that much of it. Maybe you find a track, or maybe someone has a sighting, but largely everybody out there at night, and there's no evidence that's coming from the night. I mean, We have drones, we have thermals, but the main scientists in the country don't seem interested in that at all. So I think that we're better served to spend our time out there in the day when we can see stuff, and maybe we'll get lucky and, you know, find something, or something will happen and be more compelling than when you're out there at night with a red light and you can't see 10 feet in front of you.
I mean, where do you think the perception of Bigfoot being more active at night has come from? Because obviously, when you look at the body of evidence that's out there, I would, from my personal standpoint, Russ, I would suggest that at least 90% of the really top quality sightings, encounters, interactions, whatever, happen in daytime, do they not?
Yeah, those are the ones that compel us, right? I mean, I think that the reality is, you know, so if we look at it, humans are more active during the day. So, you know, we just a fraction of the people are out at night, but fully half of all the sightings are at night. So if we have less humans out, but more sightings at night, that must mean that Bigfoot must be more active at night. Mm. But, you know, it's not like they're not around during the day, right? So in my mind, they're back in a more remote section of whatever area that they're in that they don't expect people to come into. And then at night, they go wherever they go because, you know, humans can't see very well. And as long as you're staying away from the flashlight or a car or whatever, then you're probably not going to be seen. So I think that that is, you know, that's why we know that they're more active at night. And that's probably why most of the people are going at night. But like I said, it's just about experience and not really the evidence.
Mm. Mm.
Not, for people, not for me.
Yes.
You know, I legitimately want to, you know, just like my game cameras, you know, I have 40-something of them now. They're all professional cameras. They're all expensive. So if I get a really good picture, will everybody be compelled? Probably not. But, you know, I'm carrying my GoPro all the time when I'm in the woods. You know, I think that if we had 3 or 4 seconds of fairly close, high-quality video, that it would go a long way to convincing some of the scientists.
Mm. Have you found yourself evolving as you've developed your knowledge? Because I think the other thing about this, and one of the things I've often taken from when I've heard you or when I've read your work, Russ, is that you're very humble in regards to you and the work that you do, despite the fact that I think you're one of the more open-minded yet still skeptical people out there in this field, that you are very careful not to make wild assumptions based on things that you may stumble across or find. You are just simply looking at the facts and trying to solidify those kind of things, rather than, as we were saying about the lady earlier, nodding sagely about the colour of an experiencer's shirt.
Yeah.
Sometimes it can be people have pre-created facts that for them, this means this. Whereas when you look at it properly, it means nothing, really.
I think that people discount how rare they are. Like, you know, there's a girl that I'm friends with that's really bright, that's just getting interested in it. I've been kind of mentoring her as she goes. Well, you know, she's been out maybe 2 or 3 times, but each time she goes, she thinks she finds footprints and she casts these prints, but she doesn't realize that in her whole state, there may be less than 10 or 15 of the animals, and the odds of her being in the right place just aren't very good. And so we have people that weren't raised in the outdoors that are trying to make judgments based on animals. And I don't think that they really realize it, but you know, she's bright and she's young. And so I want to encourage her and try to get her to go more into it, but she has to evolve as she's learned too. Like, for instance, when I started 15 years ago, on any given day or weekend, you may find me within a 6-hour drive. And my cameras were spread out like that too. But as time has went on, I've recognized the futility in chasing, ambulance chasing, that if you get a report, you run there to see if something's there, because there's nothing there, the animal's long gone. And I love hearing the historical reports, and I still keep track of them and all that, but I'm not going out there to look. And every place I go, every day someone says, you should go here and look around. Well, there's reports almost everywhere. Mm. So what I have done over the years, and what I have made myself feel like that I was getting somewhere, is there's these two biologists, Hukin and Sullivan, that were, I think it was state of Oregon, if I remember right. And they had a Bigfoot sighting. And so they were very serious about it for years and kept rigorous notes, and kept camera in their hands all the time. And they said that they thought it was about every 200 hours that you were in prime habitat, that you would find some type of evidence, whether you had a brief sighting or you found some scat or you found a footprint or whatever it was. And that was, for years, I kept track of everything. And I thought that that number was very good. Well, as time went on, I got to the point where I started eliminating the places I went to maybe just like three or four different places. That's the only place that I went. I went there repetitiously and I kept all my cameras in the same area. So before I may have had one or two cameras in a park or a wilderness area, but now I may have 12.
Mm.
And so now I know and understand the ecology and the animals much better than I ever did before. And then over the years, when we weren't getting pictures of Bigfoot on game cameras, and we didn't know if it was just strictly a numbers thing where there were so few of them and so few cameras relative to the amount of space, that I've learned that there's other things that I'm after. Well, of course I want a picture of Bigfoot. I've recognized other things, like I will notice in a certain area, I will have the same 10 or 20 deer that I see repetitiously, the same bobcat, the same coyotes that I'll see over and over again. But then I started to notice that I may have a week, because camera may be out a year, and I may have a week or maybe a couple weeks in the course of a year that all my animals that are normally there are gone. Something is disrupting my animals. Mm. So I don't know what it is, right? It could be a mountain lion. It could be a human that's poaching. It could be a Bigfoot. So I keep it in mind, you know, on my calendar, and I note at all these different places and different times when something appears to not be normal. And so by doing that and keeping track of historical reports, I try to show up in areas where at the same time that there was a sighting in the past, or that something had happened according to one of my cameras, or that a friend that may record, do long duration recording where they have these recorders out in the woods for 6 or 8 weeks at a time, and they'll call me and say, hey, at this place, I heard this on this date. And I keep track of it. And about 3 years ago, I was in a location where it was a park that on the exact day that I was there 3 years prior, or the, not that I was there, someone else was there, two gentlemen had a sighting. And so I was there for that exact reason, because I was reproducing the same time, same place. Not that something would necessarily be there all the time like that, but it just, I felt it increased my odds. And so I was walking, it rained the night before horribly, and I got there early in the morning with my lab shade, and him and I head up on the hill, and I could see, you know, there's no cars parked there, and there's no way for anybody else to come in for miles and miles. And I could see it's muddy from all that rain. Nobody's been there. And I got up on top of the hill, and, you know, Shade is usually off leash, but he's trained well. And he's about 20 feet in front of me all the time. And if I whistle to him or call his name, he just stops and runs to me, and I can clip him on. And I carry a leash around my neck in case I run into somebody when we're coming out of some deep place. Maybe they're afraid of dogs or they have a dog of their own. Well, in my mind, I saw a hiker not very far from me, maybe 50 yards from me. I just glanced. I saw a buff-collared person from head down to where I could see about waist high. I saw the backpack part up around their shoulders. And instantly, I just knelt down, called Shade, clipped him on, started walking maybe 5 seconds later. And as soon as I started walking, I realized what I saw was off trail. And I knew, and I was suspicious. And I ran to that place because there was a ridge right there. And I could look around forever. And there was just nothing there. And that's one of the dangers in the woods. When you're in the woods your whole life, your brain categorizes different things. It sees a tree branch moving. It thinks that's this. It hears this particular sound. It thinks that.
Mm.
I saw something and my brain instantly categorized it as a hiker. And the trap muscles, which are large on these animals that people think that, you know, it looks like that they don't have a neck really, but it's really just an enlargement of the trapezius muscles, because of course we know from science that all things have vertebrae in their neck. And, you know, but I have to remind myself all the time when I go in the woods. Now, each time before I leave my vehicle, I remind myself, I take nothing for granted. If I hear a noise, I hear something I'm not sure of, I just will go and investigate it. Because, you know, here a couple of years ago, I was in the woods and I was in this remote place and I heard this tree break. In my mind instantly, and said that was too loud for it to be something.
Mm.
And I kept kind of going and walking my way. Then later I thought, why would you make that assumption? Why would you just not walk the 100 yards over there and just take a gander?
Yeah.
But, you know, woodsmen are guilty of that. You know, we're just familiar with animals and their behavior, whether it's a bird or whatever it happens to be. And, you know, our brain categorizes it quickly for us. So in the same, I was just thinking about, you know, in the same way that people that have never been in the woods, all of a sudden those people are categorizing everything as Bigfoot because they don't know any better.
Well, I think even here in the UK, Russ, you know, we've not got a wide variety of loud creatures that you will hear out in the countryside at night at all. But I've seen people who've never heard a fox at night, and it's turned their blood cold as though it's some kind of supernatural entity that's shrieking around. But they, once you've heard it, you know what it is, and it's the same with all kinds of creatures. Even, you know, as something as innocuous as a hedgehog, that if you're not aware of what it is and it's sort of rustling about and snuffling, can put the willies up people, because it's a noise they've not heard, and there's something about nature at night that certainly you will find people who give this presence as if they're, you know, they're rough and tough and nothing's going to frighten them, they're not afraid of anything. You put them in the woods at night and more often than not they don't want to spend another night out there.
Yeah, you know, I have never had, in an expedition that I was hosting, not one time I've never had someone not leave. You know, people are not used to the woods, they're not used to the wilderness, they are hearing Bigfoot stories, it's dark, you're walking them way back in, they're not sleeping a lot because they're in a tent or they're in some cabin that's new. And it's invariably, you will see the first night or the next day, you'll just wake up and somebody will be gone. They just packed up their stuff and they left. It's just not for them. Mm. And people that watch scary movies, they're the worst. The worst. I mean, I don't watch scary movies on purpose because I'm in the woods all the time by myself, and who wants to be thinking about the possibilities? And, you know, but a lot of people, you know, they're not in the woods. And so when they watch these movies all the time, of course, it creates some scary moments for them. And even the most largest and muscular of men, you know, will run from the sound of a mouse, literally, or a squirrel that's out moving around at night.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got a resident owl that's moved in recently around here. And I had to say, the first time I heard it, I was thinking, what on earth is that? And then I realized it's 11:30. I live near a little park, clearly. And obviously listened for a half an hour, 45 minutes, and heard it a couple more times. And then you realize, oh my goodness, it's an owl. But you think, well, here I am in a major city in the UK. You sometimes are surprised just how close to the urban sprawl nature can get.
Yeah. I mean, and some of the noises, like you said, foxes make horrifying sounds. Fishers, coyotes, owls make absolutely, if you didn't know, they sound like monkeys in the woods at night many times. If you didn't know differently, that's what you would think it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, and then some of the places, like, say, Salt Fork State Park in Ohio is probably the most renowned Bigfoot place in the whole country. And you have people out there yelling at each other. There's so many people doing Bigfoot stuff in the woods that they're in the woods yelling at each other and they don't know. So I know inside the BFRO database, there's probably 50 or 60 things that are in there from Salt Fork State Park, and nobody messes with them because you just don't know what's real that comes from there. When we did the TV show Finding Bigfoot at Salt Fork, I think there was 5 episodes I helped with. We had some of us that were in the group on the outskirts of the park just to make sure that other people weren't coming in to make noises when the TV show was there.
Well, I think you've got to cross every bridge when it comes to something like that, because if there's a, and I'm sure you know this better than most, Russ, if there's a specific location that's got notorious because of people having sightings or interactions, be it hearing whooping or tree knocking or anything that's giving an indication that it's an active area for whatever reason, people will come from all over to go there. You've no idea who's going to be in that place. At the same time, there's not a rota that everybody has in the world of Bigfoot where they go, oh, well, we're going to be there on Sunday, make sure nobody else is there. Like you say, you've got to cover it, because there will be, and it's a cast iron fact, there will be reports of basically two groups of people who have been shouting at each other.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And nobody wants to tell anybody where they're going, right? You know, they all think that they have these hotspots.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's, like I said, it's a field, an interest, a enthusiasm that is largely just with people that are just off the street.
Mm.
And if you are on Facebook or some of the other groups, I mean, literally every day you just are horrified by the things that they put forth and say that they are evidence, you know, sticks that are leaning this way, or just people that maybe what they have may look like something, but they're just doing something for attention. They like that they're getting stroked.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that many people in life, you know, like, you know, I get stroked from my personal life, the people that are in my personal life, the patients that I see.
Mm.
Other people get stroked by different means, but there's people out there that aren't being fulfilled enough, and they're looking for other things in order to get attention. And maybe it's that they start fires, or maybe it's that they do this or they do that, or maybe it's that they're posting on Bigfoot stuff. You know, it's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one term I was never aware of till 3 or 4 years ago, Russ, was blob squatching. And to be honest, I've lost count of the amount of pictures of just trees that I've seen on the internet. And somebody's gone, you can clearly see it there. And you're like, no, I'm sorry. Because obviously pareidolia is a big thing in all walks of life, because the human brain will always try and create a face shape. Whatever you're looking at, be it.
Exactly.
You know, we see it in water. We see it in trees. We see it in rocks. We see it in clouds even. People will always say, oh, that looks like such and such. And so,
yes, that's right.
It's amazing to me how often you will get individuals across all kinds of internet sites who will be saying, look at this, this is incredible evidence. And it's a picture of a tree.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that the two biggest things that we've seen, say, in the last 10 years of Bigfoot are the pareidolia. And the second thing would be the woo aspect, which, you know, for the people who aren't familiar with it, woo is the sound that ghosts make, like, ooh, that type of sound. And woo is attaching a paranormal aspect to Bigfoot. People believe that they come in and out of portals, that they can shapeshift, that they, you know, they believe they're in great numbers, like that there's millions and millions of them and you just can't see them. Things like that. And, you know, I think that it's two things really has happened in the last 10 years is the proliferation of people that aren't in the woods and don't understand the woods and ecology and things that happen in the woods, the fauna and the megafaunas. I think that that is a big thing. And I think that people are just in general lazy that, you know, they're like, oh, we were following these tracks disappeared. Well, I mean, it just was not like that. I mean, they probably just lost the tracks, or maybe they weren't tracks at all. I mean, you see that with snow. Like, I mean, 99% of the tracks that I see on the internet that are in the snow are clearly something like a coyote or a hare galloping.
Mm.
But they just look at this blob and then they look at it 5 feet away and see another blob and they just make the assumption that it's something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, often it is a lack of knowledge about the world around them. And, you know, even if you ask the average person who perhaps has a garden, which is frequented by birds, Russ, I would be amazed. I would say the majority of people could not tell you the species of normal birds that come in their garden. Never mind what potential creatures or tracks or something that they would come across in a remote location, in a wood, after snow. They just don't have that body of knowledge to work back from. People see something, it's proof, rather than, and work backwards and say, right, well, this proves this point, rather than thinking, well, what is that? Why is that there? Where's it come from? Where's it going? They just go, proof.
And not having an interest in educating themselves, rather than taking a tracking class or taking a master naturalist class, they don't have an interest in doing that. They would, well, you know, they're in little groups and pockets. They're not in large groups because they wouldn't be accepted in large groups. They're in small pockets and they're people pay attention to them that don't know any better.
Mm.
It's like I said, it's hard to imagine how many scientists are probably interested in Bigfoot, but are just horrified and turned off by the non-scientific approach that people make, or attaching the paranormal aspect to something that, you know, that I believe is perfectly ordinary.
Mm. Well, people are often mystified even by normal animals, Russ, never mind elusive creatures that we're trying to find cast iron proof of, you know, that normal animals will behave in strange ways, or they will turn up in places that people simply don't expect all around the world. And often people will misunderstand something perfectly normal because either they want it to be something else, or they've no point of reference to say, well, actually, no, it's not that. It's clearly this.
Right. I mean, I don't know what the answer is to it. I guess the only solution I see long term is that, you know, there's, like I said, there's a certain percentage of us, which is very small, that are doing scientific research. There is a small percentage that are trying to learn or trying to educate themselves. And then for the rest of it, we're just going to have to wait until something becomes more acknowledged, then wait for the scientists to come out in the field then. Hmm. It's interesting because, you know, they're kind of like weather people. You know, they, when they're wrong, they just won't say they're wrong. They're just going to move forward.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter if they missed what they did yesterday or whatever. They're just going to make the assumption. I mean, science has changed so much, you know, just in the last 20 years. You know, it used to be the belief that when you talk to an anthropologist, and there's several shows that I've done where I've been on with one and us debating and talking about it, and they'll say, well, there's just not evidence. But, you know, they're just not interested. And when you say, why can't it exist? They'll just say, well, it can't exist. But the reason why they think that it can't exist is because when they were brought up and they were in school, you know, the belief scientifically was, or anthropologically, was that there was only one animal in one station, in one setting, that could exist. You didn't have things that would overlap.
Mm.
But just in the last, you know, decade, we've learned that instead of being like Homo erectus, which then became this, which then became that, which became Cro-Magnon man, which became the Homo line, it's not like that. It was all these things existed in a bush, not a line.
Yeah.
They existed side by side, interbreeding, breeding each other out of existence. So the premise that so much of it, of why Bigfoot couldn't exist, was wrong.
Mm.
And rather than saying that's wrong, so maybe we should revisit it, they would just say it's wrong. We don't really have any evidence otherwise. And I think that the public in general, I've always made the argument, you know, they're really not interested in Bigfoot. And, you know, they have a husband and wife, they have a job, they have kids, they have a house, they have friends, they have interests that they're taking care of, and their life is largely full.
Mm.
And so, you know, it's not like that they're keeping up with what's new in Bigfoot research, or, you know, the latest this or the latest that.
Mm. Mm. Well, exactly.
It's a concern.
Yeah, yeah. It is. It's something that, obviously, it's one of those subjects that, I mean, especially these days, things are moving at such a pace in certain avenues, and certain researchers are pushing the boundaries forward far quicker than I probably think anything's happened sort of before the last sort of 10 years, Russ. I think things have really moved on. As you say, there are specific individuals and organizations that are really pushing the boundaries that probably even people who think they're really interested in the subject are either not aware of, or just simply aren't keeping up with.
Yeah, I have people literally every week that tell me that they're interested in Bigfoot until they talk to me, and then they realize they're not that interested in Bigfoot because they don't. I mean, I'm probably 40 hours a week on Bigfoot.
Yeah,
you know, I'm lucky because, you know, I see patients 3 days a week now, and so, you know, 2 days a week are dedicated to, you know, that's just the week, and then the weekend I'm trying to slip away, and then because I'm getting older, I'm able to, you know, maybe a week every other month that I'm just in the woods walking around, visiting my cameras, taking my notes, you know, keeping track of stuff. And of course, you know, through the website or the West Virginia Facebook page, I'm getting new reports every week that I'm talking to people. And, you know, it changes what I believe and what I see over the years that, you know, it's evolving, I think.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I think, as I said, I'm amazed that what I thought, and I thought I was quite well up to it, and I realized just how little what I now know is going on and who's doing what and where. I probably know more than the average person who said they're into Bigfoot, but even I'm sort of in awe of some researchers that are out there that are doing it. And I know, as you were saying, this is one of the things that I think people don't appreciate sometimes, Russ, for people like yourself. You've mentioned how many game cameras you've got. I once heard you mention an eye-watering number of images you have to go through. So on average,
yes,
do you check them weekly, monthly? And if so, how many do you have to keep just flicking through and going, dear, dear, nothing, dear?
So there's places that are very, very hard for me to get to and out of the way. There's one place that this spring, it'll be 3.5 years since I've been to that camera. Mm. And so I'm using lithium batteries. It was probably okay for a year and a half. It was still taking pictures, but for sure it's dead now. But, you know, I have to here in the next month or so get up there and get it. But I would say that, you know, you don't want to take pictures. For instance, like you just don't want to take pictures on a game, like a deer trail, because if that was the way to get a Bigfoot picture, then there would be a lot more of them, right? Than the handful that people believe are real. So there have to be different ways to go about it. And you don't want, for instance, the one time I had a camera on a path that was through a clear cut that came, like a couple hollers came together, and I thought it was a good spot. Well, the camera was only there for like 3 months before it died because there was just too many deer.
Yeah.
And so, yes, you know, and like I said, we've all moved on. The ones of us that do it regularly, we're not putting in those kind of places now. So commonly my cameras will get over a year. And I would say that, you know, I have to review thousands and thousands every single time. The most I've ever had to review at one time was 12,000 on one camera. But, you know, you're looking at that same image and you're just click, 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 click. And it'll take hours to get through, you know, what you're looking for. hours and hours and hours and hours. And then the most frustrating thing is, you know, sometimes because it's technology, they'll malfunction. And you may have had a camera out for 6 or 9 months and it didn't take any pictures. on a couple of occasions, someone has stole, like, for instance, there was this park in Ohio, and I usually have a good relationship with the rangers that are in these particular parks, and they know who I am, and, you know, and I text with them and communicate with them, and I send them pictures, and they like to put them on their websites, you know, maybe of big bucks or bobcats or whatever it happens to be that is cool. Mm. And so there was this one area that this ranger had told me that if it was up to her, this is where she would go. So I went in there, and it was like maybe a 3 or 4 mile road. And I was in there in February, beginning of February, a few inches of snow on the ground. I'd been there for a couple of weeks, and there was no trails of anybody's vehicle. So I knew no one had been in there but me. And so I got back in the woods, and, you know, I'm walking up this hollow. There's not a path or a trail, and on both sides of me are clear cuts. And I can tell from when the timbering, what it looks like, that they were both about 15 years old. And so when I'm looking at that, I'm watching the deer trails go back and forth and tracks and whatnot. And I realize and recognize when I get up to the hollow, all of a sudden it stops. And when it stops, it alerts me. It should stop. It, you know, it looks similar. The terrain is similar. There shouldn't be a reason for it to stop. Hmm. So because it stopped, it made me suspicious. And I pulled out one of my cameras and set up a game camera there to see if I could figure out what was causing, you know, the disruption in the animals there. Mm. And when I was putting it up, I heard a wood knock, which is a sound, one of the sounds that a Bigfoot may make. And it was loud. It was maybe 100 yards from me up the hollow farther, and loud enough my dog turned and looked as well.
Yeah.
And I said, that's where we're going, Bub. And so him and I started walking up the hollow further. And then there was another little side hollow that came off. And I thought, if I can just get a camera in here real quick, nothing will know I'm here. And I was putting a camera up, and then it was only maybe 50 or 60 feet from me, but it was just where I couldn't see. Mm. And I made another one of those loud noises, and, you know, and I left that area then after that. But, you know, so I had that encounter, and, you know, of course I'm noting it in my notes and whatnot. So next year I go back in there to prepare for that time that they may be coming through that area. And I put 7 cameras out in there in just a small area. And when I came back, 3 of my cameras had been stolen, even though they're locked up and it's a remote location. You know, somebody was just in there. And it was just not only that I lost a camera that was very expensive, probably $500 each. Mm. It was just that I lost that time.
Yeah.
You know, because that's the one thing that I can't replace is time. And that's why, you know, like when I see some of the researchers or scientists they're interested in, it always concerns me because I see they're getting older. I see that, you know, like, you know, how many more years can I continue to do what I do? You know, can I do it for a long time? That's why I work out all the time and I eat well, because I want to keep doing it. But I feel the sense of urgency. You know, and a couple of years ago, I was at some conference and I was speaking and I was having lunch with Dr. Meldrum and Cliff Erickman from the TV show Finding Bigfoot. Mm. And they were interested in, you know, what I'm doing, because I'm always doing all these things in the woods, right? These experiments and these different things I'm trying out to see if I can entice the curiosity of some primate out there.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they were interested. And Cliff told me, he said, I just don't get to do it much anymore, man. I'm just speaking all the time. And as soon as he said it, it just clicked with me. And I thought, you know, I'm a doctor. I don't have to do that. I get to do whatever I want to. Mm-hmm. So I already make a living. You know, a lot of the people that are doing the circuit, you know, that's how they're making part of their livelihood.
Yeah.
And so when I came home, I just canceled a bunch of speeches I had that were all over the Eastern United States from top to bottom. And I just said, I'm sorry, I'm just not speaking right now. And frankly, between my podcast and the ones that I'm a guest on and the two books, I mean, haven't people like heard me enough? You know what I mean? Like, it's not hard to know what I think, you know what I mean? So largely, I've only spoke one more time after that. And that was a favor for Cliff from the TV show, because it was during COVID and he couldn't make it to a place. And I went for him in his place. But other than that, I haven't done it anymore, because I just want to be in the woods. I need to resolve it. I need to figure it out. Mm. And it takes a special person to be in your life at home with you when you're doing that, because, you know, if someone else may be sitting with their significant other watching TV, well, I'm sitting there, but I've got a magnifying glass on a map, you know, and every night I may look, well, hours a week I'm looking, trying to figure out why there was a sighting here at a particular time, and is there a hollow that I'm overlooking, and that some other thing that I could do better. And, you know, but I'm passionate and I'm consumed with it. And I don't know, like I said, there's not a lot of us, but there are some of us across the country that are like this, that are very, very ate up with it. There's some people that are doing valuable work on their computers that maybe physically they're just not in the shape to be able to get back in the woods, you know, very far.
Yeah. I think it's all about balance.
Yeah, I can see that. I think those people are relying on, you know, Bigfoot's back somewhere, wherever it is during the day, right? Or maybe a family group of them. And then toward night, they're creeping forward where they can get food, you know, and it may be a dumpster, it may be a campground, it may be whatever it happens to be. Maybe it's an orchard or a big family farm. And they're creeping, creeping, creeping forward until when it gets dark, you know, then they'll come through there during that period. And I guess that, you know, for many people, they're not interested in where they come from or the journey on how they get there. They're just saying, if I sit here, maybe they'll come in.
Hmm. I suppose it's a double-edged sword, as you refer to there, because for some people, it's almost some kind of religion that they have to spread the word, Russ, about their belief and what they think and where they've been and what they know. And yet you've got to balance it up with spreading the word against, as you say, balancing having a life, getting out there and doing the real research, because at the end of the day, there's only so many conferences you can speak at or so many times you can write a book about a specific area or a specific case. But when you start to think, it's all about time management, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I saw yesterday on Facebook that Dr. Meldrum, you know, he's very renowned and, you know, and people want to hear him speak. And I mean, I don't remember the exact number, but just already he's probably got a dozen speeches lined up. So between his home life and having a dozen speeches, how much time is he getting in the woods?
Yeah.
How much time? Nothing. Nothing. Some of the most renowned researchers that people are interested in, when I have them on my show and I'm talking to them or I'm talking to them privately, it's shocking how little people are in the woods. So it's not really that shocking that, you know, we haven't made huge strides. There's just not enough people out there because, you know, we can't do it for a living. Mm. Or the location. I mean, many of the people maybe live in a place where, you know, if I was able to turn the world upside down right now, there'd probably be a Bigfoot, you know, within 20 minutes or 30 minutes of me where I'm at. But I live in the middle of a wilderness area. But for other people, you know, they may have to drive hours or something like that to be around.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the other thing as well. And the other aspect of all this is, Ross, you can't just turn up for 2 days and on the off chance. If you're going to go, you've got to go hard, haven't you? You've got to go in there for a week, 2 weeks, a month. You've got to really commit, especially if you're coming out of state. You know, when I spoke to Shelley, who lives down in Texas, and she was on about the drive up to the Olympic Peninsula, which for somebody like me living in the UK, which basically takes, if you put your foot down, you can do it in about 14 hours from one end of the country to the other, traffic willing, Russ. Whereas, you know, Shelley's on about driving from Texas to Oregon or Washington State, and it's like a 34-hour drive, and she's not left the country, right. You know?
Right, right. Yeah, it's a challenge for sure. I mean, I don't think that, I don't know how people really expect that we're going to get much beyond unless we just, you know, I think it's going to have to be a fortuitous break. I mean, there's some renowned, I say that round too flippantly, but I mean, like the Wood Ape guys down the Southwest are awesome. The Olympic Peninsula guys are great. You know, there's a lot of really good BFRO people that are around doing stuff, but you know, you really just don't have many groups other than that. It's mostly just weekend warrior type things. And that's once again, assuming that you're going to a place and an animal that can't stay really in the same place largely, right? Because they're so large that they'd exhaust all the food in a particular area. So they have to move around a little bit. Mm. So you're just taking a chance that you're going to be in the right area. And I always, of course, most people weren't ever dog hunters, but I would always tell them, you know, listen, I would lose my coonhounds and it's not like he's hiding from me and I know where I lost them at, but sometimes it would be days before they would turn up and they go to houses, you know, so people just can't fathom, an animal that, you know, is reticent, is leery of, while it's curious about humans, it's generally just avoids them and is afraid of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so it's raised for generations, knowing where the food is, knowing where people go, where people don't go. I mean, but even aside from that, there's still a lot of sightings. I mean, there's tens of thousands of sightings. And, you know, if it was a court of law, I'm sure that if you could give me, I could throw out 50% of the sightings and say they were misidentifications. And I could throw out almost all the rest of them and just say, well, they're just not that good. Mm. If you just let me keep, say, the best 400 or 500, they would be unimpeachable. They're people like Action Jackson, the game warden, the forest ranger that patrolled Yellowstone, the most remote section, for his whole livelihood, for all those years of horseback protecting the park. And what does he say when he gets done? That he had a daytime sighting of Bigfoot. Mm. Do you think that Action Jackson doesn't know what animals look like? He spent his whole life there.
Yeah.
I think that there's stories like that that are, you know, maybe every year I'll get one like that out of Ohio or one in West Virginia that are exceptional. They are a, you know, some type of forest ranger or a, you know, just somebody that had a clear daytime unimpeachable sighting that you can put on a lie detector test. So if we were in a court of law, I feel certain that the jury would find that, yes, that they probably exist. But of course, you know, that's not the standard by which, you know, something new is judged.
Yeah. Well, as I've always said, Russ, it only takes one to be real. And that's it. It's an end of story.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Simple as that. And yeah, as we speak, there's been this recent study that said, oh, well, everybody that's reporting seeing Bigfoot's misidentifying a black bear. And it's really frustrated me because it's one of those studies that as someone that, as you say, I'm very much in the camp of there's something out there, but I'm also balanced enough to understand that there's also a lot of nonsense and hoax and fakery and misidentification out there as well, and these things happen.
Okay.
All depends on the type of the witness, as we were talking about earlier on. People who live in the cities and don't have much experience of the outdoors in general, never mind looking for Bigfoot. But it seems to me it's one of those sites, one of those studies where someone's gone, I'm not interested in anything to do with the account other than someone said they saw something, because I've read the report and there is no correlation between the actual witness statement and what they've said happened. They've just said, Bigfoot sighting, it's a black bear. Whereas when you look at some of the reports, this is the thing that often sets it apart. They don't take into consideration the witness, their employment, as you've just been saying, their background, their job, where they live, where they work, their knowledge of the environment. None of that is taken into consideration. They don't take into consideration, you know, if I see something running on two legs, swinging its arms, even, you know, with the greatest respect, nobody's going to think that's a bear. And it's so frustrating because these kind of things get accepted into the mainstream and people go, oh, well, they've proved everybody's wrong. And I thought, well, hang on a minute. 20 years ago, they were saying that Ray Wallace had faked every footprint found in North America. So they need to make their mind up because 20 years ago it was all fakery and now it's bears. I mean, neither of the studies, they're biased studies to give the result that the person doing it wanted.
Anybody that's serious about it, when we see those things, we just look at them and they're laughable. But they attempt to paint such a broad stroke across it. Like, human witnesses are notoriously unreliable in certain things. Distance, height, things like that they're not good at. But I find it perfectly believable that a person that lives in Appalachia in the broad daylight can tell you whether or not something was a bear or not a bear if they're a bear hunter. You know what I mean? It's not reasonable to do that. So I think it's that we can't just whitewash and throw it all out. We just have to say, you know, majority of the cases maybe even are fake. But if you threw all those out, there's still cases, many of them, hundreds of them, that are totally unimpeachable, totally reliable, that would leave any jury and any scientist just say, well, I don't know. Because really, there's only two choices, right? Either, well, three, it's real, the person lied, or the person misidentified something. It's one of those three things.
Mm. Well, exactly.
And so usually they're not comfortable saying somebody lied when you know, it's like a scientist, it's a game warden, it's a state trooper. You know, they're not comfortable saying, so the state trooper lied. He had a daytime sighting, one ran in front of his car. He saw it very closely, and this is what it looked like. But you think that it was a bear or that he's lying.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
But that's what the things that the internet does is, like, you know, it gives everybody a voice, which is cool, right? Mm. But it gives people a voice sometimes that they shouldn't have because there's no accountability with the voice. You know, when we were in school, when we're growing up, if you said somebody said something about somebody, you might get punched in the nose.
Yes.
Well, now you can say all kinds of things and horrible things, and there's no accountability. Mm. You can have an opinion even if you're not entitled or qualified to have an opinion. You still get to have an opinion.
Mm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I always said I'm a big believer in allowing people to have their beliefs and say what they wish. However, if you make certain statements or you say certain things, there should be repercussions regardless. You know, you can't just carte blanche, Russ, because then the world burns.
Right.
I mean, a prime example is, as you're saying there, I mean, the first report that you've got, because obviously in the back of the updated, you've got some new encounters that you've added to this.
Yeah.
I mean, what the first one itself, as we're talking about people being mistaken, you had a couple on ATVs who were, yeah, what, 25 yards away?
Yeah, a state trooper and his wife. And, you know, they're riding their four-wheeler like many do here in West Virginia. And now it's mainly side-by-sides. And, you know, we believe that a lot of times these animals would travel on right-of-ways because they go long straight distances and generally avoid habitation or human presence. And in West Virginia, there's a lot of them because we produce so much coal energy here that, you know, they're going out of the state everywhere. Mm. And so these people were putting along on off the side of one, and he looked up and he said he saw a firebird stump, but he kept looking down at the ground to see if he could see any places that ginseng would be. And when he looked back, and he asked me, have you ever seen one? And I said, no. And he said, I'm not saying that they do it, but people disappear all the time. And he said, they're so big, they're the size of a sheet of plywood. Of course, he would be talking about a large adult male. Mm. And he said, I tried to hit reverse, and I'm wearing my pistol. My wife is like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And he's like, look, 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 look. And she just starts screaming, oh, my God, no. Oh, my God, no. And still, you know, like, they moved into town because she would hear something outside and think that Bigfoot was outside. Mm. I went back there and took them around. Another state trooper was there. It was at night. They were standing there. Both of them had their guns drawn. The one guy that had the sighting was crying, was chain smoking. Mm. He saw something.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, apparently it was miraculous because two people saw the exact same thing in the daytime, but they were both wrong, right? They both misidentified it. Sometimes it's just not reasonable.
Well, yeah, this is often sometimes when you hear people explain things away like that, you think often the explanation is more ludicrous than actually just accepting that, yeah, maybe there is something strange out there lurking in the woods. Why, you know, I mean, for God's sake, there's a famous story that's broken over here in the last week or so, Russ, about a tourist on holiday in Papua New Guinea who's discovered three species that were supposed to be extinct on holiday.
Right. So, well, you know, similar to that story is, you know, here in, like in Florida in the United States, there was a gentleman that was a houndsman. He hunts mountain lions. And so he was camping, vacationing with his wife. And so he asked the ranger, so how many mountain lions you guys have here? And the ranger said, we don't have any here. And the gentleman said, oh, you certainly do. He said, you know, I've heard them and saw their sign everywhere since I've been here. Well, they had that gentleman bring over his hounds, and I forget the exact number, but in one day, they had treed like seven different lions. That's how they came to know that they had mountain lions in Florida.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I think that people, I don't know, maybe it's the human genome that it makes us feel comfortable to feel like we know things or put things in boxes and close things out. When reality, we don't know as much as we think that we should or do, and we just don't allow for there to be variances in what we know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. There's nothing wrong with saying you don't know something, Russ. And I think too many people are afraid of not being able to have an answer.
I can tell you that seeing patients, I say I don't know every single day. Because I've learned in my 31 years of seeing patients, 250,000 visits, that it's much better just to look at my patient in the eye and just tell them, I just don't know. Let's try to find out.
Yeah. Well, I think the last thing I want to touch on before I let you go, Russ, and thank you so much for spending your afternoon speaking with me. Obviously, you are continuing to research and track things out. So how many active cases do you think you've got on the burner at the moment? I know when I've heard you speak previously, you've often had double figures constantly running.
Yeah, I would say that that's a fair number, that at any given time, there's probably 10 to 15 active cases. You know, it depends on the time of the year, you know, like there's not as many during the winter, but you know, now, it was 80 here in West Virginia one day last week, and today it's sunny and in the 60s. So people are out more. And so of course you have to have those people out more in order to get a, you know, to have a witness, and an encounter. And so I suspect that we'll start seeing more. Most encounters happen in the summer or early fall.
Mm-hmm. Oh, incredible. Well, onward with the search, and I just wish you the continued best of luck with it all, Russ, and I'm always interested to hear what you have to say or what you've written about a variety of topics in this particular field. So where can everybody listen to your show, find your work, or follow you online, my friend?
So if they want to find the book, of course, they're on Amazon, but you can also go on thebigfootdoc.com, which is my website. It'll have a link to the podcast, which is called Wide Open Research on the Untold Radio Network. The first book was out 8 years ago. It was award-winning and did really well. The second book came out last year and was number one on Amazon for 17 weeks.
Yeah.
And then I just released the second edition of the first book, which I added like another 100 pages and a bunch of new stuff and new reports. And so I'm excited to see how it's received.
Mm.
And that was just like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Maybe 2 weeks this Thursday or tomorrow, maybe. So I'm excited about that. And, you know, so if people would love to listen, I'd love to hear or reach out if they have a story they want to tell me. You know, I'm always interested in hearing something. I mean, every day I'm sending somebody a message saying, I want to hear your story.
Mm, fabulous. Fabulous. Russ, it's been a real pleasure to finally get a chance to speak with you.
Hey, thank you so much. Hey. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Hey, no problems. I hope I get a chance to speak to you again down the line, my friend.
Me too.
Okay. Thank you, Russ. Take care.